I can't think of a better time than to have Greg Braden on the program with his knowledge. It's an incredible moment. A couple of his books, by the way, The Turning Point, Creating Resilience in a Time of Extremes, and, of course, Resilience from the Heart as well. Lots of things to talk with Greg about in these very strange times. He's next with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Great to be back with you. George Norrie here with Greg Braden. Greg, of course, is a New York Times best-selling author, internationally renowned as a pioneer in bridging science, ancient wisdom, and the real world. 2015 nominee for the prestigious Templeton Award as well. Now, he was a computer geologist during the 1970s in the energy crisis. He worked as a senior computer systems designer with Martin Marietta Defense Systems as well. In 91, he was a technical operations manager for Cisco Systems. But things changed in 1986. Going back a little bit, Greg has explored high mountain villages, remote monasteries, forgotten texts to merge very timeless secrets with the best of science today. And again, a number of his works, including The Turning Point and also Resilience from the Heart. Greg, welcome back, my friend.
George, it's good to hear your voice. I am absolutely thrilled to be with you and our audience tonight. Thank you for inviting me onto the program.
Hey, congratulations, by the way, on the Templeton Award nomination.
Well, you know, thank you very much. I'm honored. I was surprised when I learned of the nomination, and even more surprised when the Templeton Committee accepted that nomination. And it's a 5-year standing nomination, George.
Wow. So,
the award went to a very, very deserving gentleman, a European man, in March of this year, and it is a standing nomination through the year 2020. So I'm tremendously honored, and it's exciting.
Just being in that company is a great honor, isn't it?
Well, it is, and it would be at any time, and especially now, George, as you mentioned, this is certainly no ordinary time in our world or our nation or any nation for that matter, and to have the kind of work that we're doing. This award, and some of our listeners may not be familiar with the award, Sir John Templeton felt that the Nobel Prize in Science, as significant as it is, doesn't go far enough because it left out the spiritual dimension of our human existence. And he created this award specifically pegged to the Nobel Prize in Science for those who would incorporate the spiritual dimension and give it the significance that he felt was so deserving and reflecting our lives. And it began it in 1978, I believe, was the first award. And it, I think it reflects in the award what science is now revealing in the newest discoveries, that there's so much more to us than we've been led to believe and that we've imagined in the past. And it's really, Georgia, it's really becoming difficult to draw a solid line between physical science and what we now call spirituality, because they're blending so quickly together. So
does science see that blending, Greg? Do they spot that?
You know, that's a question I'm asked frequently, and one of the places I think where perhaps the best example is there is no longer a question in scientific, serious scientists who accept the peer-reviewed science. There is no longer a question as to whether or not we're connected with one another and with the Earth any longer. The question, quantum physics has now told us beyond any reasonable doubt that connection exists. The question now, George, the big question is, to what degree are we connected, and how deeply are we able to influence the world around us and our physical bodies in ways that we're only beginning to understand? And I think this is one of the places where that line has become very fuzzy. When I was in school back in the 60s and 70s, and even our young people in school today, this is the quandary, George. The new discoveries are changing 150 years of the way we've been taught to think of ourselves and our relationship to the world and solve our problems on the one hand. And on the other hand, there is a reluctance, and sometimes it's just a flat-out resistance, to share those discoveries in the mainstream. And that includes mainstream textbooks and mainstream classrooms. So our young people are being taught an obsolete science and being asked to solve the problems that we've led to them, that were created through the thinking that led to the problems to begin with. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Why is science, Greg, so hesitant in bringing forth some of these newer discoveries and newer teachings?
You know, it's a very good question, and I have friends of mine in academia, for example, when I've asked these questions, and I think there are two things that are happening on a very high level, George, and I think you and our listeners have certainly seen what I'm going to say here. Science has been hijacked by corporations, by politics, by religion. Science in its truest form, it can serve us tremendously by answering the deepest questions of our existence, and science has done a very good job of doing that, and science is designed to be constantly updated with new information. And what we're finding now is that science, pop science, and the science that's taught in the mainstream is largely stuck in a scientific story that we've all been steeped in, and it is a story of separation. We've been taught that we're separate from our body, separate from the world, essentially powerless when it comes to our own healing, powerless when it comes to our influence in the world around us, and that the principles of Darwin, that nature, the fundamental law of nature, is based in competition and conflict. Each of those has been scientifically proven to be false. Peer-reviewed science has told us now that nature is based in cooperation and mutual aid, not competition and conflict, and that we are deeply connected to our own bodies and the world around us, yet that is not what is being taught in the classrooms and textbooks today. And for that reason, the young people, the millennials, that are looking at the world that is unfolding around them, and they're saying, you know, how are we going to solve these problems? And they're trying to solve them through the same thinking that led to the problems.
Is it frustrating for them?
For the millennials, I think it's beyond frustrating. I think they feel so disaffected that they, you know, they're looking at the world and they're saying, these aren't our problems. I was just on a Wednesday afternoon after the Paris bombings. I was invited to be on a panel discussion with some very distinguished scholars and researchers, some of them dealing with apartheid in South Africa and helping to bring that to a close, and you know, who have worked on large scale big issues in the past. And on this panel, they invited a young millennial man who I think he was 27 years old, and he shared the view from his peers. You know, they're looking. This is so interesting, George, and we talked about this in depth. They have never seen the kinds of things unfolding in the world that we're seeing now, the atrocities, the horrors, the aggression. Doesn't make any sense to them, and they don't have a point of reference to know that these things have happened before, that there are, this isn't new. It's new to these young people. They've never lived in a world where these things didn't exist.
No, so in the 20s, the genocide was probably worse than what's happening right now.
Sure, but they're trying to solve them from a place of rational thinking and logic, and what's happening is so irrational and so illogical that those principles simply aren't applying. And so they can say, you know, it's not our problem. That's the thinking. What's happening is it's becoming everyone's problem because, you know, the events that we've seen the last 2 weeks, they're not isolated and they're not limited to only a certain part of the world. They're becoming global. And that's because we now live in a global world. We are deeply connected as a society.
Greg, you call your work Resilience from the Heart, but the subtitle is interesting, The Power to Thrive in Life's Extremes, which is happening right now. But when you talk about extremes, what are we talking about?
Well, the best minds of our time, George, are telling us in no uncertain terms that we are living in what is being called a time of extremes. And I say that, so it's not not a Greg Braden theory or, you know, my hypothesis. These are
happening.
Very, very well accepted. And it's a time of extremes, and what that means is that our world is changing, and it's in ways that we've never seen, in ways that we're not used to. For most people, I think it's fair to say the world is changing faster than we have been prepared to accept. And this is really fascinating to me, George. This is the 30th year that I've offered this work in one form or another.
Good for you.
my 30-year anniversary. And in those 30 years and through some of the positions, the corporate positions in the defense industry during the Cold War, for example, I've had the opportunity to meet presidents, religious leaders, political leaders, spiritual leaders, indigenous elders from all over the world. And every one of them, George, that I've spoken with in the last 30 years, every one of them knew, and they've told us, they expected a time of tremendous change. They knew it was coming. Yet every one of them that I've spoken with recently is absolutely blown away by how quickly the change is unfolding and sweeping the earth in a way that they thought it would take a couple of generations. They didn't expect it to happen in a decade.
The Internet's done it, Greg, I think.
Yeah, well, what that means is that we've got to think and live differently, perhaps more so now, George, than any time in the past. And this is where the new discoveries, this isn't just based on faith, peer-reviewed science. We've asked science to solve problems and help us understand our relationship to ourselves and the world and how things work. And science has done that. So the question is, are we willing to accept the answers that science is now offering? And it has deep implications from the physical world around us all the way down to the spiritual implications of who we are and where we come from and our relationship to our bodies and to the world around us. So the resilience happens on multiple levels. There's personal resilience, there's community resilience, and we talk about all of those in the book, but the key is to honor the discoveries that we have asked science to make on our behalf. Science was designed to serve us, and it does so very well, but the key is we have to accept what science has revealed, and when it comes to politics, religion, the environment, all kinds of things, it's difficult. So I'm just going to go back. You ask about this time of extremes. What we know with absolute certainty is the extremes there are largely due to the convergence of three cycles that are rarely talked about in Western education, but they are very well known in many of the Eastern traditions and indigenous traditions.
So three like Earth-type cycles or life-changing cycles?
Well, the first, they're all cycles based in natural rhythms. The first are climate cycles. The second are economic cycles. And when we talk about economies, people often think that's all about money. And while it certainly may include money, when we talk about economies, at the deepest sense, it's about us and the way that we share vital resources with one another, food, water, medicine, energy, communications. The way communities help one another, money can be involved, and I've studied and shared time in communities where there was no money, and they had very viable economies. So the economic cycles are playing out now. The really interesting one, George, that we hear about very seldom in the West, is that there are cycles of conflict. Human interactions are governed by natural rhythms, and there are what are called conflict or war cycles. There are large 56-year cycles. There are 17.7-year cycles. And these are based on rhythms developed by the economist Kondratiev in the late 1800s, early 1900s. These principles were being developed. So the major conflicts, when you go back in history, and I'm a student of these cycles, and it's fascinating me, the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam, mm-hmm. All of these are at the peaks and the valleys of these conflict cycles, 17.7-year cycles. And where this is interesting is we entered into one of these cycles, 2014, the upturn of one of these cycles. It peaks in the year 2017, and then it dips down through the year 2020. And what that means is from 2014 to 2020, we are in one of these conflict cycles. It doesn't mean we must have war. I want to be really clear about that. It means there's a vulnerability or a susceptibility, and this is where the value of understanding these cycles, these natural rhythms that all life is governed to some degree by these natural rhythms. If you know that we're in one of these very delicate, sensitive cycles, it says to our political leaders, it says to our negotiators that this is a delicate time. And maybe go the extra step and take the time to make sure that our communications are very clear and maybe show a little flexibility in whatever it is that we're dealing with.
You know what's so weird too, Greg? You talk about 2020. That's only 5 years away.
I know it is. Yeah, it sounds like a doesn't it sound like a long time.
Oh my God! It sounds like way into the future, doesn't it?
It does. And when we think about this, it's actually becoming the goal. The UN is working on projects. You know, World Vision 2020. I had an interesting experience. Another one of your guests, I know, Dr. Bruce Lipton has
been
this show in the past. The United Nations in the year 2000 was, they developed what were called the Millennium Development Goals, MDGs, which they identified the areas for the next 15 years where they would put their energy, their resources, their preparations. And those goals expired in the year 2015. That's now. Last fall, 2014, knowing that these goals were going to expire, they invited Bruce Lipton and I were invited to speak to a group at the UN in New York, and they asked us from our perspective. They said, okay, these goals are expiring. What do you see happening for the next 15 years? What kinds of things can we expect so that we can become resilient to the kinds of changes that we're seeing and know where to direct our resources and our energy? And those goals, we had the opportunity to share those goals. This was in the fall of 14. And just about 2 months ago, the UN now released the what are now called the Sustainable Development Goals, is what they're being called now, SDG. And they reflected some of the principles that Bruce and I were talking about, the principles of cooperation rather than competition, for example, reflecting the truest nature of nature's fundamental rule. And I shared with them the fact that these cycles are present. And the value of the cycles, it's not that we're a slave to the cycles.
Now, are the cycles the same as extremes, or is that different?
Well, I think what's happening is any one of these cycles would be something that we would have to deal with. The fact that these three major cycles are converging in the same small window of time that happens to be our lifetime, that is what has created the extremes in our world. As the climate changes, it changes where we grow our food, how we grow our food, where and how people live. It's changing industries, and that means jobs disappear in some places and appear in others. That's changing economies. All those things reflected in this, and conflict cycles as well.
Unfortunately, with the jobs, Greg, they're appearing in places we are not.
Well, this is part of what we were saying to the UN when we were having this conversation. All of this can be, it's not a problem, George, if we are honest, truthful, and factual with ourselves, and we acknowledge that now is different, and it's the normalcy bias. I think the tendency to overlook things that we know are going to create big change in our lives. We don't like to do that as individuals. We don't like to do it as societies. And history is full of beautiful examples of where normalcy bias prevents people from stepping up and really embracing the change in a healthy way. This is the thing. We're always going to have change. How do we embrace it in a healthy way? And if we can acknowledge it and prepare for it, it's not so much of a problem. But it's when my mom is a perfect example. You know, when she looks at the world and she thinks things are just falling apart at the seams for no apparent reason and that the world has gone crazy.
Well, when you compare it to her days, she's probably right.
Yeah, well, and it's easy to think that way, George. And when we can lay a template of cycles of change to give some meaning. I mean, there's obviously insanity happening in the world right now, and I'm not saying we can account for all those things, but we do know from looking at when these cycles converge, it is a time of tremendous volatility in everything we're talking
Hold
about.
Hold on, Greg. We're going to take a quick break. We will come right back as we talk about your work, Resilience from the Heart, the power to thrive in life's extremes. And welcome back to Coast, Greg Braden with us. Greg, these extremes, are they good or bad? Does it matter?
You know, it's a question that comes up in scientific circles all the time, George, because from a biologist's point of view, the extremes in our world are triggers for evolution. And evolution generally is a good thing. It catapults us into new ways of thinking and living. On the flip side, for the people living the time of extremes, if we're caught off guard, if we don't know what's happening, and you know, like my mom, the world just looks like it's falling apart at the seams. Her exact words, she says, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. That's what she says to me all the time. I'm not even really sure what that means, but I know what the intent behind it is.
Is she right?
You know, it's the world is in transition, and what we have done in the past is unsustainable. And this is part of the good news, George, and I speak with my live audiences very early in the program. What I'd like to say is that there is some good news, and part of the good news is we already have all of the solutions for every one of the big problems in the world today, technologically. We have all the food we need to feed every mouth of every child, woman, and man on the face of the earth, and the UN tells us, unless an asteroid hits the planet or something like that.
Which could happen.
Food security for another 50 years. We've had for almost a century the technology to build clean, safe, efficient, sustainable electricity with no fossil fuel, zero greenhouse gases. We know how to create strong economies that are beyond the consumer model that we have right now. When it comes to communities, we don't have to guess. We know there's a community in northern Arizona, 5,000 people, growing their own food, producing 100% of their own electricity. They have 100% employment rate for everybody that wants to work because they work helping to grow the food and produce the electricity. So we have these major technological solutions. What's missing, George, is the thinking that will embrace these and make them a priority in our lives. And I believe that the reason we are yet to see so many of these really beautiful, positive, powerful solutions is this normalcy bias that we're talking about, that people are clinging to an idea of the way the world used to be that we all were very familiar with, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, and they're waiting for things to get back to normal. And when we really look, when I talk to people and we do the interviews and I work on these committees, the normal that they're hoping for, it cannot exist because that world is gone. So part of the resilience, the emotional resilience, is being able to embrace the new normal that we see now in a healthy, positive way rather than struggling to go back to something that no longer exists.
So how do you put this all together? How does an individual, Greg, put this all together in this trying time of extremes?
Well, this is why I wrote these two books, George, and it was a reflection of people. In the last 15 years, I've been on every continent of the earth except Antarctica. I haven't been there yet. Not every nation, but I've been on every continent. So it's not just Americans. It's not just the West. Indigenous cultures, people in the East, everyone is feeling this shift. And the book, I broke the resilience down into two levels. There's personal resilience and social and community resilience. And the personal resilience, I wanted to study people who have gone through tremendous amounts of change to find out how they, not just survive, but how do they transform their lives and how do they transcend the crises of their time to become better people and create better communities. That journey, George, has taken me into some of the most isolated and remote and pristine and beautiful places remaining on the earth today, about the highlands in central China and Tibet and the Andes Mountains of Bolivia and Peru and all through the desert southwest and the Aboriginal peoples in Australia. And what we find, there are common themes among all of these people that have gone through big change. And what we find is that the personal change for them begins in their hearts. And we used to think that was a metaphor, just kind of a new thought, new agey kind of metaphor. And now new discoveries, some radical new discoveries in science are telling us, these people nailed it right on, that our hearts specifically are designed to help us to embrace change in a healthy way. And when we begin to adapt to what it is that our heart really offers to us, it opens the door to extraordinary states, not only of resilience, but extraordinary states of human awareness, consciousness, deep states of intuition, spontaneous healing, all of those. And it all stems from a couple of discoveries in the human heart. So this is why we can't possibly predict everything that's going to happen in the big world out there. I know people that are trying, and then they're going crazy doing it.
But do you believe in prophecy?
Do I believe in prophecy?
Yes.
Absolutely, because from my perspective, prophecy, from both ancient and current, is the result of those who learn to tap into their hearts in very precise ways on the quantum level and to follow the trends and the cycles to their logical conclusion. And that's the thing about prophecy. It can only tell us from the perspective of the viewer. There's a fine line between remote viewing, prophecy, prediction, all of these things, kind of come into the same conversation. But we always have the ability to change whatever is viewed in a prophecy or a prediction. And I think that's the key. Even some of our listeners may remember the Bible code when Michael Drosnin was really talking about what was found in the Bible code in the 90s and all the dire predictions and prophecies that were he had found in the Bible code.
Sure.
One of the fascinating things to me about that was statistically near all of the places where something bad was supposed to happen, an atomic holocaust or, some kind of a war or a chemical attack or something like that, there were the words, "Will you change it?" So there were four words, "Will you change it?" Suggesting that even on the quantum level, wherever that code came from, and there's a whole conversation we could have about that, that there is always the opportunity for us to intervene on a conscious level. They're called choice points.
So you think we can alter prophecy?
I believe we can. I believe the prophecy tells us what's possible if a timeline continues on a trajectory that was seen from the point of the person doing that was seeing into the future, the person seeing the prophecy. But I believe that, George, and I think the evidence supports that. When we understand quantum principles and we understand our relationship to fields of energy in those quantum principles, you can think of it like this. When we see an event, whether it's in a personal relationship or something between communities or something on a global level, between nations, that event is the result of a series of waves that were put in place by conscious or unconscious choices at some point in time. So those waves of potential begin to ripple through that quantum field. And they will continue to a logical outcome unless something intervenes and changes those waves. And this is, I think, the value of prophecy. Because prophecy can tell us what it is that is possible if we don't change that trajectory. And this is, in the year 2010, I released a book entitled Fractal Time. And it explores precisely this topic. And it also shows us that every time a cycle ends, before the next cycle begins, there's a point where neither exist. And our ancestors knew this. They called it the crack between the worlds. We call it a choice point. And this is where our opportunity to change those cycles, to change that ripple, are most potent. So on a personal level, this is where personal healing, miraculous healing, comes in. If we know the choice point in our personal lives, or if we know the choice point in a conflict between nations. So it's, again, I'm not saying that we're governed by the cycles. I'm saying there's cycles and trends that are playing out, and if we know our relationship to those cycles and trends, we can embrace them in a healthy way and know when to create those changes.
Think of the Christmas Carol, the old Scrooge in black and white, where Scrooge was looking in a window. This is toward the end. And one of the ghosts of, the Christmas to come or whatever you call that, he was looking at Tiny Tim, I guess, withering away, or he was about to die, or he did die. And he said, "Are these things that will be or could be?" And he was basically saying, can the future be altered? And I'm not sure, Greg, this is where I may differ with you, I'm not sure we can alter the predictions of the future or the prophecy of the future. I think they're kind of like etched in stone, that somewhere along the line, if, you know, we say 6 billion people are going to die of some Holocaust, I think if we avoid one thing to stop that, they'll get hit by an asteroid and get killed.
Oh, okay.
See, that's where I come from. I think people can try to alter it, but I think something else steps in to do what it's going to do.
Well, I think it's a fascinating conversation, and we don't know for certain. My sense from my time I've spent with indigenous peoples who they don't call it prophecy, but it's what we would call prophecy, plays a central role in their lives. To what we now know of quantum physics, it all comes back to whether or not we believe that we are an intentional species and we are on a conscious path from a beginning to an end, or is everything completely random and chaos? And I believe that we are living a matrix of quantum possibilities, and I think that's what the Bible code is all about. I think that's what remote viewing is all about, what prophecies are all about. We're looking into specific places in that matrix of possibilities. And that is the key, George, for our existence here, if we are to embrace our most cherished and ancient spiritual indigenous traditions. They all tell us that we have a choice. It's all about choice and free will. And if we have the wisdom to recognize the truest nature of who we are in our relationship to the world, I believe we can shift those potentials. And if we do not, then I believe those potentials play out just the way they've been shared in the prophecies.
Now, Greg, when you talked about new discoveries, what are some of those discoveries, just so we can
see what's going on. Comes together, George. You know, we have been led to believe that we're separate from our world and essentially powerless when it comes to our relationship to the world. If we, anyone who is listening to this program, if we've been educated in the West in the last 150 years, we've been steeped in a scientific story based in separation, competition, conflict, and struggle. And we believe that subconsciously. It plays out in our personal lives. It plays out collectively in the economic system, in the corporate system, in the way we solve problems. So when we talk about our ability to influence these things, it sounds mystical to some people. In the year 1991, there was a discovery. It was published in the journal Neurocardiology. So this is a very prestigious journal, of the discovery of 40,000 specialized cells in the human heart that hadn't been recognized in the way that they were in 91 previously. These specialized cells, they're called sensory neurites, and that's a little bit of a technical term for very similar to brain cells, except they're not in the brain. They're in the heart.
They're in the heart.
However, there's such a concentration of them in the heart that the term now, it's actually called the little brain in the heart. Our listeners can Google that, little brain in the heart.
Huh.
And what they found, George, is that these cells, they have the ability to function independently of the cranial brain. So these cells can think on their own, they can remember on their own, they can solve problems on their own, they can learn on their own, or under certain circumstances, and this is what we talk about in the book, we can merge this little brain in the heart with the big brain in the head, the cranial brain. We can marry these two separate organs, the heart and the brain, but a single potent neural network. We marry those separate networks together, and all of a sudden it opens the door to some of the most mystical, profound, and what are called extraordinary states.
Well, isn't it possible that with this little brain in the heart, that all of us who believe in the conscious mind, in the power of thought, in ESP. What if we're wrong, Greg? What if it's all physical, and that if you cut out the brain, take it away, none of that other stuff exists?
Well, if we cut out the brain, what this is saying to us is that we have an entirely new way. In some cultures, it's new. In some cultures, it's very common and very, very commonly accepted. Without the brain, the heart still has the ability to connect, to remember, to learn, to think, to influence, and to function at this quantum level. So what the science now is showing is that when we marry the heart and the brain together, these two separate but related neural networks, it opens the door to the deepest states of intuition and insight, precognition. It opens the door, a hotline to the subconscious. It processes information much faster than simply thinking with the brain. It also triggers about 1,300 biochemical reactions in our bodies. And it tips the scale of balance in our favor in terms of super immune system and anti-aging hormones. And coming back to the beginning of this conversation, it is this connection that gives us greater resilience to change in life. So what we now know is that when we're young, when we first come into this world, and we have to respond to the unknown world very quickly, the distance from one heartbeat to the next, if you look at an EKG, the distance from the peak of one heartbeat to the next and then the one after that, the distance between each of those varies with each heartbeat when we're very young. It's actually called heart rate variability, or HRV. And as we get older, George, we become more set in our ways, more rigid in our thinking, and that's actually reflected in the rhythm of the heart. We lose that heart rate variability. The heart rate becomes more even. And when it becomes more even, we lose our resilience to change. Change becomes more difficult for us. So by connecting this heart-brain network, we can change it. We can reverse that. We can become very resilient. And that's why we talk about it in the book. This is the big picture. We're living this time of extremes. It's stressful for all of us. The stress is showing up in our societies as increased levels of cancers and
it's everywhere.
All kinds of inflammation-related illness and disease, all linked to stress. Even aging now is being linked to stress and the erosion of the telomeres at the end of the DNA. And by linking this heart-brain connection, by harmonizing, I'm going to use this word, harmonizing the heart and the brain, that is our way of finding resilience in our own lives to whatever it is that the world brings to our doorstep. We don't know what's going to happen in the big world, but we've got to be able to deal with big change. This is how the Tibetans have done it. This is how the Andean peoples have done it. This is how the shamans and the Yucatan have done this. So by honoring this facet of our existence, we open the door to some of the most extraordinary human experiences and become healthier while we're doing it.
Let's talk about the power of using this, Greg, and we'll take phone calls next hour on Coast to Coast AM.